Oh.
Are we still on the air?
Oh, yes, we are.
What timing.
That was entertaining. Let's just talk with the microphones on all the time.
We can do that.
Now, what was it you had to say? This doesn't sound like Axis music, does it?
Could.
Well, I could change that.
I don't know. This sounds like something it should be mixed with.
Ah. I could certainly do that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's something that can be used here.
Oh, sure. Well, let's try this. Because that's just a little too...
environmentally?
Healthy sounding. Let's do some of this along with it.
Some of what? Oh, here's something.
There. Is that better?
I'm not sure yet.
Okay, deep breath, everyone. We're organized. Ah.
During his State of the Union address earlier in the week, Acting President G.W. Bushwack named North Korea, Iraq, Iran, and the 7-Eleven on G Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., as an axis of evil. That's a pretty harsh indictment of a country, no matter how odious its national hygiene habits are, and certainly no reason to lump it in with that clerk who chronically underfills the big gulps that members of the Office of Homemaker Security have a hankering for on Friday nights. Anyway, much as he would like his phrase to qualify for sound bites of the century, Mr. Bushwax was not the first use of that phrase.
Is that like earwax? Bushwax?
Not wax, wax.
Oh, whack.
Wax.
Ah, thank you.
At least three other recorded utterings of it precede his. During the John T. Scopes monkey trial of 1925... Yes, well done. Which pitted a fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible against the teaching of evolution in Tennessee schools. Prosecuting attorney William Jennings Bryan, looking for a cliche of his own, called Darwin's theory the axes of evolution. That's axes, A-X-E-S. He likened the art of teaching to a ladder up which students had to climb to secure knowledge. Each rung upon which they trod represented a kernel of wisdom that the students needed for a well-rounded education. Reaching the top of the ladder and stepping off was akin to graduating from school, a rite of passage from student to adulthood. But by indoctrinating them with that heretical Darwinism nonsense, Scopes' students were forced to climb the ladder in the wrong direction. In particular, Bryan contended, the two rungs that represented the theory of natural selection and secular humanism were contrary to traditional biblical teachings.
I can't even say those together.
What, biblical teachings?
Yes, natural selection. I can't say those. That my tongue does not wrap around those words.
Have some salt.
Ah, salt.
They should be proscribed. Defense counsel Clarence Darrow later humiliated Bryan by pointing out that two rungs don't make a right. And after I read that, I realized there's something missing in my joke. I missed some. I left something out.
Humor.
That, yes, but the humor would not have been left out had I not left out a very important sentence.
About?
I don't remember.
Right, about the right.
Something about the right.
Yes.
Something to tie it in. Two rungs don't make a right. Ha. All right, I'll have to work on this.
Yes,
because
please.
There's something, it's too bad.
Rewrite that.
Rewrite, as in R-I-T-E?
Send that back for a read.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Want to have some music first?
Please. Meanwhile, a January 1972 headline in the Las Vegas Times that read, "An Excess of Evil," referred to the plethora of appearances by motorcycle daredevil Evil Knievel. Knievel began his death-defying, and you can look this up, evilknievel.com. You did?
Of course.
Of course. Ah, I should have known. Knievel began his death-defying stunts by jumping over a bus. As his courage, or foolhardiness, grew, so did the number of buses, to 30. He also jumped over houses, a shark-infested aquarium, a small civil war in Argentina, and the Snake River Canyon in Idaho. No matter, he was breaking bones, his own, at a pace that would eventually land him in the Guinness Book of World Records with 35, he was always publicity-hungry enough to make daredevil appearances at the drop of a hatchet. A proposal to jump over Grand Canyon prompted the Vegas headline. He didn't do that. He was planning, but he didn't do it.
Well, are you sure?
Am I sure?
Because although I didn't see it on there, I do remember at least some learning channel, something or other, or whatever that those slow talker channels are, talking about the daredevil stunts that he'd done, including showing the setup at the Grand Canyon.
Yes, he was permitted. He was refused permission to do that by the National Park Service.
Good for them.
And in 1973, avant-garde composer Harry Partch designed and built an Axis of Evil, an instrument of collected percussive effects to complement his Spoils of War, another instrument of collected percussive effects that he built 23 years earlier.
But it was really a joke, you see, because it was had nothing to do with Axis of Evil. It was he really wrote it in a kind of Leonardo da Vinci style. It really reads backwards. It was really a live fossixa.
That's what you think.
Yes, because it had six elements to it.
Six. Hmm. Aside from the demeanor of the first person who played the Axis, Eugenio V. Cross, a chronically crabby individual, the V stood for very, the instrument had nothing to do with evil. Evil. Rather, its primary component was the axle of a civvy, an Indian ambulance that the Bombay Motor Works factory produced from 1940 till 1982. And Axis of Evil is an anagram of Axle, A-X-L-E, of civvy. The Axis was featured in Parch's very last composition, Viola Fixes, for attenuated viola, hyperomochromium, boo, and Axis, after which it was destroyed by an unappreciative audience member who still bore a grudge against the outcome of the Scopes trial. So when homemaker security minions who bear grudges against convenience store lackeys accuse them of being in league with an Axis of Evil, they aren't inventing a term that will last long in the Soundbite Top 100, much as this 348th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar is not anticipated to make the top 100 of cleverly conceived, flawlessly produced, and fashionably au courant radiophonic broadcasts, unless somehow rescued in the nick of time by Calvos.
Which I can do by turning these knobs off and having us not talk anymore.
Oh, what fun is that?
Yes. Well, no fun for us.
For the audience.
Well, let's listen to the remaining 2 minutes of the mix of Audio Destinations' The Home Planet, along with Carl Heinz Essel's Unchained from Crude.
Thank you.
Well,
huh.
Speaking of axles of evil, yeah. and your figure eights in the ice, that was The Home Planet from Audio Destinations by Samuel Pellman, combined with music by Karlheinz Essel, in this case Unchained from his CD Crude. Well, some pieces just go together. That electroacoustic stuff, just there's something about kind of a Borgian, speaking of Matt Borgie, who isn't here, kind of a Borg-like influence in the electroacoustic world, where you can combine pieces with no loss of sense, coherency, congruity, or character.
Ah, such as resistance is futile.
Yeah, kind of like that. That's exactly what I meant.
Yes.
It's a kind of collective electroacoustic consciousness that seems to pervade so much of the electroacoustic world. It's lots of fun. Anyway, we've got new releases today, unless composer Matt Borgie actually shows up, which was an option.
But he could be a new release as well.
And if you're here to listen to the interview with Corey Karlick, that ain't going to happen because Canada Post and the U.S. Postal Service had some sort of disagreement on how long it would take them to get a simple envelope from Ottawa to Montpelier.
Probably it's being irradiated.
Yeah, it probably is, to get rid of all of those, what was that name of that company?
Cooties.
The one that makes all that genetic engineering stuff?
Enron.
Yes, that must be it. All right, we're going to do all kinds of new releases today. Some are new releases of old music. Some are new releases of new stuff. Michel Van der A, whose interview we did not collect while we were in the Netherlands, has a brand new CD
is
out.
Is he holding a toothbrush? I can't quite.
No,
make
he's
out.
Holding his. He's ripping his face off.
Oh, I see. How very clever.
That's a Michel Van der A ripping off a mask of the face of Michel Van der A.
Uh huh.
This is very, you know, very avant-garde.
Right.
Whatever that means. So we have here a two CD set on Do Namus, and we're going to listen to at least one of those. We have, I don't know. We have so many options.
You want to do an entire show of mix, just put as many on the old CD players as possible, just run them through?
You mean until Matt Borgie shows up, or what?
If he does.
Well, I suppose we can do that. Let's at least listen to one piece straight through. This will take us to the top of the hour, and we'll find out if he's going to be here. Here's a piece called Between for Percussion Quartet, Michel Van der A. Very interesting face mask he's ripping off.
Yeah, it looks like him.
Between Percussion Quartet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michel van der Aa in a brand new CD release from Donamus, right out of the Netherlands. That's his piece for four percussionists. They didn't have a whole lot of loud stuff to do. That's called Between.
Yeah, I kept waiting for the beats and such.
Yeah, it's for percussion quartet and electronics as well. Gosh, we've been in sort of on an electronic roll, so we better do something about that, like, really soon. What do you think about it?
Nah.
This is Andrew Schultz. You're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar. So don't touch that dial. You don't know where it's been.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
Ooh.
Calvos and Damien is the flagship show of the non-pop international network. Now broadcasting.
And that's good, huh?
Yes, it is, because we were joined by a few new stations, so we now have in the network the latest score out of Provincetown, Massachusetts on WOMR-FM, Where's the Beat on CKUT-FM in Montreal, Inner Space in FM 100.5 in Zagreb, Croatia, Foldover, WOBC-FM, Oberlin, Ohio, A Missing Sense Electric Storm, that's up on CKLN in Toronto. And finally, the Sonic Stratosphere on KSER, Seattle.
And together, all those radio stations add up to what?
Add up to...
Eight!
Eight!
Yes!
Eight,
how about
eight,
that? I knew we could get
yes,
the math if we tried
eight.
Hard enough.
I didn't add them up.
And speaking of trying hard enough,
yes,
we tried to bring in a live composophiler, and it worked.
And it worked. You just conjure the mists, and they appear.
They're the misters.
There are composers under every tire in the ice. you're driving along, and before you know, boom, you've hit another one in the road.
What a lovely metaphor.
Matt Borgi's here. Hey, Matt, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right. You are kind of a surprise guest for a couple of reasons. We got
because he was asleep earlier.
Yes, yeah. He was asleep earlier. He didn't know he was going to be a guest. He said he was going to show up. He didn't realize that our interview with Corey Karlick, if you've tuned in for that, it's still in the post between Ottawa and Vermont somewhere. And so with all the changes, here you are, and we're going to listen to pretty much all of your CD today. You've got to introduce yourself and do your own bio, because your CD was so informative. Basically, all you did was thank Mom and Dad and give
abstract.
The names of the pieces.
Yeah, it's the abstract.
Uh-huh. So you're kind of a long-distance distance learning student here at Goddard College.
Yeah, I'm from Detroit. I'm enrolled in the off-campus BA program. It's just long way from Detroit, not so much geographically, but as far as the state of mind goes.
What? it is?
Yeah. It's pretty different here. You know, people ask me, so you go to Vermont? And I'm like, Vermont? Yeah, I'm in rural Vermont. And all of Vermont's rural. So
you come from Motor City, and this is Motor City.
It's kind of different here, but it's cool. It's nice because I get a chance to really learn. And this semester I'm working on a lot of composition and stuff. So I'm really excited about that, and it's a cool program to, you know, learn and do pretty much what you want.
There's a music program here?
Well,
stunned.
What do you do when you're back in Detroit? I mean, how does that program work when you're out there, when you're back there?
We come up with a study plan when we're here.
Yes.
And then after that, there's five packets. There's a packet every 3 weeks. And then with that, you just kind of...
Sounds like a drug deal.
Like I'm on drugs most of the time. Anyway, so the thing of it is we do these five packets. We structure the study plan, and we, like, correspond, lots of mail, email, stuff like that over the next, I think it's like 17 weeks total.
Yeah.
And so that's a semester, and it's really intense. Got to be pretty organized to do it, but it's well worth it if you're in self-learning and stuff like that. So.
How did you get involved in music as a creative musician, as a composer, and how did you find out about this place?
Well, that's a multi-point question. How did I get involved?
You could ignore two of them and just answer one.
Yeah, ignore the last one and just tell us about your bio.
Well, you know, I'll talk about that, but I want to talk about how I found the show and how I found you guys as well. So I'm kind of interested in that. I was actually doing some music journalist or a music writer, and that's kind of how I make a living, albeit not much of one, at home. And I was researching an artist. I was actually looking for a bio on Tom Heasley, and I came across you guys, and I was like, hey, wait a minute. And I was totally overwhelmed by how, like, comprehensive the database you guys had. You know, and I was just like, there was just, like, all this information. I was like, whoa. And then I found out there was the show. But then I found out the show was out of Goddard. And I'm like, yo, that's really weird.
Wait a minute, you're going here and you don't know about it.
Yeah, well, no. And so I was like, well, that's kind of fun. Because I knew Tom had played a show here in August, and, you know, I think I even asked him via email, Tom, where are you playing in Montpelier? Because he had contacted me about some Detroit venues, and there aren't any. So unless he wants to play in a street corner, and I was just kind of like, you know, there's not much point in coming here because there's just not a whole lot of venues for, you know, listening kind of music or a contemplative kind of music, which I'm really only familiar with his contemplative. Well, I don't know if you want to call it contemplative. There's one really loud part where he starts talking through his tuba on the end of his record. I think it might be his only solo release. I don't know if
that's
you guys
right.
know.
That's right. His only solo release.
He,
for benefit of our listeners, Tom Heasley was at the Ottman Festival. He plays tuba and does electronics with that in live extended improvisations of 20 minutes to a half hour or more. And we played his stuff on the air, and we'll be hearing his concert as well when we get to it in our Ottman broadcasts coming up in a month or so.
And that's really cool. So that was basically, and then you know, like I, you know, I talked to him about, you know, the performance in Montpelier, and then I was kind of like, well, and then I forgot, but one thing led to another, and I found out Station was here, and I'm like, there's such a time warp when I'm here. It's either it's like either eat, sleep, or read, and I was like, to come and talk to you guys would be the ultimate chance to break that monotony that I've experienced so many
now,
times.
We can be monotonous too. You can be monotonous.
Well, yeah, but not in the same way, because, you know, I'm a little.
Because this time you get to be monotonous.
I got
monotonous,
the beta waves going now, so I'm a little more awake, you know. But the thing of it is, it's just like I spend the rest of the time like as a drone, just kind of school, eat, you know, sleep, and it's just like it's kind of a, you know, I'm super motivated about my music, and the closest I come to is a really badly out of tune piano if anyone knows the Manor House on campus, and kind of plunk away and feel like I'm like John Cage doing some prepared piano on a really out of tune thing. Sounds more like Schoenberg, but whatever, it's all good. So it's a chance to, you know, play around and so I'm kind of long-winded. Yeah.
So how did you get into it? Now we know how you.
Yeah,
found
how
us.
Did I get into it? Well, it's a strange story. I think this steady progression over the last 2.5 to 3 years of discs. You know, and the first one was kind of crazy compositions. First off, I should say most of my music thus far has been of an ambient or contemplative nature. It's all influenced by, I was really influenced by what would be, I don't know, academic electronic music or early electronic music. In this day and age, it's really hard with electronic music because a dude spinning records constitutes electronic music. And yeah, okay, that makes sense if you're Pierre Schaeffer, but it's a little different if you're, you know, a DJ spinning at clubs. To me, that's not electronic, that's a dude spinning records. And so my music was really inspired in a contemplative way by, you know, Musique Concrète and Pierre Schaeffer. And
Pierre Schaeffer is one of the sort of originators, one of the leaders in the early field of electronics,
yeah,
particularly ambient electronics and acousmatics.
Yeah, and he was one of the few guys where it's actually listenable and it's not based on a serial music, like, I don't know, Milton Babbitt or somebody like that, where it's a dodecaphonic or like a 12-tone bass, like, it's really hard and it's kind of a Varese angle. I don't know if it's to be more experienced or listened to. And so Schaeffer, while his recordings are really scratchy, I was really appreciated him, and I appreciated the aesthetic of his recordings and the warmth and the kind of the honesty of it too. But then I guess, you know, you can – but mind you, I wasn't into these things really before I got into music. I had a really cheap four-track that was missing a lot – there, a really cheap four-track and a broken keyboard that my friend had in his garbage that I saw as I was pulling in his driveway. Mm-hmm. And I had always kind of wanted to experiment with drones and things of that nature. And it was some late night in August 5 years ago or something, and I had this keyboard and I had this four-track, and I started holding – I remember it was like a D minor triad. I held it down for like 30 minutes, and then I overdubbed it about three times, and I ran it through tremolo, and I ran it through distortion, and I ran it through – pretty much all the gimmicky guitar effects I had each time. And after a while, I was like, you know, this hold it down. This kind of sucks. So I just started taping down the keys. And I just held it, and I would tweak the volume through the reverb. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. This is like the ultimate in Zen composition. I'm doing without doing right here, you know. And so, I don't know. So one thing led to another, and things have kind of come along. The sound quality on that, I mean, I was everyone was breaking on me when I put out the record that eventually carried that track, because everything had hiss and noise and it sounded like a Pierre Schaeffer record. I mean, it was horrible. And
not horrible, no.
everyone would give me, because in ambient music or in space music or whatever the genres of that, you know, you have Hollywood sound designers.
Yeah, I mean, you have that purity of sound that everybody goes for. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's marked by people like Steve Roach or Robert Rich, who, you know, is like the sound guru geek himself. And yeah, probably not making too many friends by saying that, but whatever. The thing of it is,
you are here.
Yeah, and it's too clean. It's almost too clean, and it's the stereophonicness. I don't know if that's a word. Of it is cool and it's wide, but at the same time, it doesn't have the warmth. It has that cold digital feeling, and you know, I have to, you know, he mastered. I'm pretty sure he mastered Tom Easley's record as well. And I think he masters most of the stuff on the Hypnos label, I'm pretty sure. And so there's a real width to it. But it's always pretty cold and clinical almost feeling. It's not warm. And usually contemplative in a droney kind of sense. But anyways, how did I get into it? So it kind of evolved from there.
Okay.
It started with that, and then it's gotten shorter. It's gotten longer. It's gotten more programmatic. I mean, it depends really on the record, I guess. You know. So.
Well, let's hear something.
Yes, definitely.
From your CD.
Yes, we need to.
We have the CD with this
record
great,
here.
It's a great title, "The Intercepted Transmissions with the Cyber Zen Sound Engine."
Let me just say one thing about this recording. This was a long distance collaboration. I actually sent this the. You'll hear my part. It's guitar. It's kind of a far out mid range. Sounds like it's poorly mixed. These guys actually sketched the whole record out, put the whole idea together, named all the songs. And they pretty much did everything. I made a disc of, I believe, 12 tracks, and I sent it out to, like, 15 artists because I wanted to see how each one of these artists would reinterpret my work. And I pretty much gave them what I had, and it was hands-off. I was like, do what you do. And most people didn't respond. A couple did. This was really the fruit of that work, and that was a while ago. And it's as someone who didn't create most of the music but got an equal billing for it, it's really a fantastic record. And this sounds like a horrible plug. My part was so small, and actually they're like, yeah, Matt, we're going to get the sketches to you any day now. And I'm like, yeah, right. And they kept saying that for like a year. And then it seemed like almost like a year and a half. And I'm like, man, I'm not going to see anything, whatever. Then when it came in the mail, like in August, I was just in total awe at what they had created. I was like, whoa, this is like moved very far beyond my compositional abilities and stuff. So yeah. So.
Matt Borgi's our guest. We're going to hear a cut from this. Shall we start from the top?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's do it. This is Mars in Furs from the Intercepted Transmissions.
And who do we have playing?
We have Grace Node X and Smith 6079.
I knew that.
Bet you did. Here it is.
Thank you.
Music by Matt Borge and friends there. Matt, you said you had an absolute passion for this kind of stuff. Give us a rundown of that.
Tell us how it evolved. Where did it come from?
Well, like I was saying, I started working with that one composition, and it sort of evolved from there. And prior to that, I didn't really have, I didn't know too much about. I mean, that recording that you just heard falls a little more along the lines of like an ambient slash ambient slash contemplative. Most of my other work has been in the area of ambient and the like.
Mm-hmm.
Ambient, you know, maybe needs a little bit of a definition. Ambient's usually, there's a couple of different schools of thought on ambient. One of them being that, you know, ambient music evolved from two places. There's a holy trinity of ambient, and that is John Cage, Brian Eno, and Eric Satie. And if you listen to particularly some of John Cage's more abstract stuff, like some of the imaginary landscapes, as well as Eric Satie's furniture music, and Brian Eno's ambient series. And
I wonder if Satie knew he was participating in that trio.
The way they talk about Satie, he wasn't aware of a whole lot of anything. He was not just an abstract, they usually schlep him in with Dada and stuff. And he went to the beat of his own drummer. That was pretty much it. And I'm not totally sure what he was cognizant of, but, you know, he created really beautiful, simplistic music. And a lot of times, again, he schlepped in with Impressionism, like Ravel and Debussy and stuff of that period. And, I mean, they drank coffee in the same cafes, but their music was quite, I mean, he was probably pretty close to one of the first minimalists, you know, and especially when you get into, his Vexation.
Which goes on forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long can that be played?
Yeah, a long,
48 days?
Something like that.
It's really long, and maybe, it's like, you know, John Cage talks about in his book Silence, he talks about, you know, when something the effect of when something's really hard to listen to for a really long time, keep listening and it'll become interesting. And that's kind of, you know, I think probably one of his philosophies. John Cage, in my opinion, created a whole lot of crummy music, but you could never get past the awesome ideas he had behind the music. His ideas were just, they were awesome. I mean, there's just, but at times his music, from a pure listenability standpoint, couldn't really stand up. You more needed a thesis or something to read in order to understand just what exactly it was he was trying to do. Now, that's not the case with all of his music, or his organized sound, as the case may be. But anyways, how did I get into music? Well, like I say, I started doing it. I think I owned zero ambient records. I had no idea what ambient music was. I had no idea what a space music was, or contemplative music, or you could even say that word.
But did you hear some Satie or some Cage or something?
I was familiar with Satie. I was familiar with Cage. I was familiar with all these guys. But I wasn't. I was familiar with like Eric Satie's. Here I go trying to pronounce this and sound musicological. But his Gymnopédies and his Nociennes. I'm not sure if that's right, but I was familiar with those. Mm-hmm. And I study like guitar in a classical and jazz traditions, and I really always enjoyed the sonorous qualities of his work, both on any instrument, whether it be for flute and guitar, whether it be on the original piano transcriptions of his work. I really appreciated it. You know, and not only appreciate it, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it thoroughly. I still do. And so I was listening to Jacques Lussier's Eric Satie record. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Fantastic record. It's a jazz trio, and he redoes these Eric Satie pieces with little improv cadences. And stuff. It's cool. It's a good record. Anyways, So I don't know. I forgot. I lost my train of thought. But talking about ambient, I know if I go into that, it's not a simple. Yeah.
We're talking about your passion, is what we're really talking about.
And I think it's showing coming through.
Yeah.
it just comes out. You know, they said earlier today when I was in an advising group that I talk in semicolons. And I think that's pretty accurate because I do. But it's just the ambient music. Like I say, there's generally speaking, there's two schools. You know, one includes the holy trinity of an almost utility, like a utilitarian music. One is used for altering the ambience of your space or something like that. And you get all that mumbo-jumbo. And it crosses into this field of acoustic ecology, which, like, with, like, Armory Schaeffer and stuff. But, which is a Canadian composer-writer who's pretty awesome, writes some pretty great stuff, as well as being a composer. But I'm not familiar with his compositional work. Anyways, it gets into that kind of stuff and is sort of a changing the ambience of your space kind of aesthetic. Which is kind of neat. A lot of people may be happy with the ambience of their space. But in my case, I live in a rural area, and a lot of times it's really quiet, so I put the music on. Or a perfect example is when I used to stay in the dorms here. I would turn this ambient music up, and it would drown out the sounds of people getting drunk and stamping their feet and sound like they were doing renditions of Stomp on the floor above me, you know? And it would drown it out, and it would enable me to sleep.
So at this unnamed college.
Yeah, right, at this unnamed college. Yeah, so that's one of the things. There's another school ambient, which is like Beats and stuff like that, like the Orb and Aphex Twin and stuff that came out of the UK's 1990s.
Aphex Twin is making their reputation more and more, especially they actually won the Golden Nika last year, the big Austrian Prix Ars Electronica. Aphex Twin won that one last year. So they're really making their reputation.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's weird because the guy behind it, what's his name, Richard D. James, I believe, he's actually composed something like thousands and thousands of pieces under, like, at least two dozen different names. He releases them. Like, he has something like five or six simultaneous releases at any given time under a different name. And the Aphex Twin stuff actually is getting better and better. More experimental. At the time, it was pretty derivative of that traditional 808 and 909 bass drum sound, kind of electronica that kind of was just club music and kind of schlocky. It was all right, but I mean, it was real derivative, and that was a lot of times, and still is to a lot of folks, called ambient. And I guess to some degree it is. It takes, like space music might be, or new age, in the case where it takes the contemplative aspect of ambient music and fuses it with this music. But then does that make Madonna ambient?
Sure.
You know, so I mean, who can tell? It's anyone's guess.
Let's hear another piece. Let's go on to the second cut on this CD. The cover of this CD has just disappeared into the library of the radio station.
Things have happened.
Yeah, so I no longer know the title of this piece.
Is that not behind you?
Is it behind me?
On the
It has been replaced. I see. Well, all right. Let's Whispering Across Oceans.
Cool.
All right. Here it is. Cool. Matt Borge and Friends. Well, we were moving into the next one, echolocation, which we heard at the earlier today, before the official beginning of the program, we heard that. That was Whispering Across Oceans. The guest today is Matt Borgi.
Hard to believe that we, just off microphone, were having a discussion about Mahler.
About Mahler.
The resurrection of his recording.
About Mahler.
This is what it's supposed to be all about.
But, well, yeah, you were, how do we get into that? You were...
Talking about, he was asking if we wrote notes, a different style.
Interpretations of score.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, what, so how do you create your pieces?
God, I plug them into my computer and hope I can make
go pretty much.
You know, it's really weird. It's like I'm always kind of inspired by abstract stuff. Like this semester, this is kind of far out. Maybe you guys will get a kick out of this. Maybe you think it's just way pretentious, and this is why I'm on the off-campus program. The thing of it is this...
What,
the,
they won't let you in because it's so sophisticated?
Yeah,
here.
Right. Something like that.
So
the thing of it is I'm working on four pieces this semester. The first piece is going to be based on Jackson Pollock's Lavender Mist. And my personal interpretation of it, not represented by anything physically to create the inspiration sonically. Yikes. The second thing is going to be on, and this just happens to be this way because it's on the top of my head this way, Monet's Winter Landscape from 1880. Again, I'm going to record based on the impression the piece gives me, based on Monet's non-2020 vision-having self and his impression on a piece. Next step after this, and this starts where it gets really abstract and kind of scary. The next one is going to be based on an impression of a feeling of Albert Camus' main character in The Stranger, Monsieur Marceau, I believe, when he first realizes the only time in the book he has any consciousness is when he realizes he's going to be in jail for the rest of his life. And so I'm going to make a piece based on that feeling that I believe he has as he's realizing consciousness really for the first time in the book. Yikes again. The last one, this is a personal fave, is my feeling that Tom Joad had in John Huston's 1939 adaptation of The Grapes of Wrath, when he's forced to leave his family and go on the run from the law at the end. The book is cool, but the movie, it's just the blacks and the whites, and it's just so moving. And these are, I was left with impressions, and it's totally abstract. In fact, the idea is kind of like abstract composition. And it's a similar way that I go when I create.
I saw that movie. It was the first movie I ever saw at a drive-in.
Ooh.
I was there with older relatives stuffed in the back seat while I don't know what was going on in the front seat, but all I know is I was looking out the window at The Grapes of Wrath in a drive-in. That was the 1950s. Now, that was a long time after it was released, but by God, I remember that movie.
And what was your abstract reaction to it?
My abstract reaction was that I still remember it to this day. It made a big stamp on my head, like, yeah.
Yeah. It is one of the, I mean, in my opinion, it's probably one of the better movies. I'm not going to say ever. That's so hard.
But how do you make pieces based on these? Do you do multiple takes? Do you work them over and over and over? How do you actually go about the creation of the piece? When do you get satisfied?
The way things really work, this is the strangest thing. For me, one of the things I do is when I make a recording, I believe an artist needs to kind of like, they need to, each record, each offering needs to, I don't know if necessarily outdo is the word, but probably do better than the previous recording. And not better in a production standpoint, but like their process should evolve. And I'm always focused on the process and how can I take me and my voice and the idiom I create in and make it new. Not necessarily new to the genre, not necessarily new to anything other than what is new to me. It's just I have to push the envelope to see where I can take it and to see if I can go somewhere new. That's the challenge. So I might do a record and it might take me 12 weeks of experimentation. Then once I get the process down, everything for me is formulaic. Once I get the process down, I usually record the whole thing straight. I've been practicing and I've been crafting it and shaping it. And, you know, like the mid-range part, in, excuse me, in this guitar, is, or the mid-range part in this recording is guitar. It's acoustic guitar. And anybody that's familiar with ambient genre or other styles of music, there's a guy, well, there's Robert Fripp who did a lot of work, but there's another guy named Jeff Pierce. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with him. He has done some weird stuff with the guitar. I mean, he's made the guitar do some things the guitar doesn't normally do. And the danger in this genre, because it's a kind of a small, close-knit genre, the danger of it is when you do something with a guitar, the danger is coming off sounding like him. And he's a cool guy, and he probably wouldn't care if you sounded like him. But in my mind, it's like if I'm going to sound like him, I want to arrive at it without him in mind. Because then, to me, it's just kind of ripping off his style. And so he, in a lot of ways, is the benchmark for ambient guitar. Before him was Robert Fripp and some of his work with King Crimson and Brian Eno. That was the benchmark for the ambient guitar, and it's evolved quite a bit with Jeff Pierce. So I don't know. So the guitar is a prominent thing. One of the things, you know, I really hope to document at some point, and I still, I just don't feel like I can do it well, is piano. I'm really interested in the sustain pedal and the overtones of that. And I believe there's actually a record out now with George Crumb. It's new. I read about it in The Wire. And he actually mic'd, and it's an electroacoustic thing where he modifies the overtones. So it's just a process. You know, I just kind of go at it.
Wow.
So, yeah, I just kind of push the envelope a little further each time and try and, you know, get somewhere.
Do you find that the cuts on the CD that we're playing are different? There's an evolution from the first to the last?
Yeah. Like I say, I didn't compose most of the... I composed the source
yes,
material.
Right.
These guys, I say, I did an interview with them for a Texas station, and that came up. That was really the first time we'd interacted.
Uh-huh.
We exchanged a couple brief emails, exchanged mailing addresses, and we've done the bulk of this release with only a couple actual phone conversations. And we did this phone interview. I said to them, I go, you know, you guys really beat this into shape. And I forget their name, their stage names. I only know them as Dan and Clay. Dan is Grace Note X, and Clay is Smith 6079 or something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so the thing of it is Clay stepped in. Clay is very, very quiet. And he's very quiet. And or at least he seems that way to me, because I mostly talked with Dan and stuff. And Clay was like, you know, man, we didn't beat anything in a shape. We just let it happen. And because of the stuff you provided, it happened, and it happened well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, well, I didn't really know what to say. I was just kind of like, I'm humbled, because if my stuff can give you guys the ideas to create that. I mean, that to me I don't even think about it a lot of times. That was one of the greatest things. And someone who, you know, doesn't really understand about, okay, my name is on it, but they did all the work. I can step back from that recording, and just one of the things I always try to do as a composer, and I was lucky in this case, because I can step back from this recording and I can say, it's not mine. It's really theirs. I mean, they created it. I created some stuff they worked with. They give me equal billing and all that, but at the end of the day, I really believe it was their work that created that recording. And I believe there is a programmatic feel to it, or a bit of a, you know, beginning, middle, and end. But what they might have had in mind as far as a program or song titles, I have the worst habit of, because I produce so much music, that song titles too often are a way for me to differentiate between what the tracks are and what record they belong on. I did a record last spring called December Impressions, and I was so tired of trying to come up with songs that I just called them December Impressions in 11 sequences and gave them Roman numerals.
Yeah.
And it's because the music is the focal point. The songs and the mythos that might go with song titles and stuff like that, it's just, I don't know. I'm a writer, but it's just, it's not the part I prefer to emphasize, I guess. You know?
Let's go on to the next.
Yeah, the ambient pieces are usually a little bit longer than the ones that are in this particular CD, and we'll get back to talking about that. But let's listen to actually the longest cut on this. This is called He Called Me Butterfly. Our guest today is Matt Borgi.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's that buzzing and humming you were talking about in that track. He called me Butterfly. This on the CD with a CyberZen sound engine called the Intercepted Transmissions.
The amazing dichotomy between music and composer.
Yeah. I mean, you're like, you know, you put the big key in your back and twist it a few times, and you are off. And this music, you know, just goes the other way.
I know. Isn't it weird?
How is that? How come?
I think, you know, and that's someone nobody's ever mentioned, but why do I make this contemplative music, but I'm, like, totally wired? I don't know. I think because when I suffer burnout, it's the only music I can listen to. You know, it's just other music just kind of, like, fills the ether and doesn't really do anything for me or give me – certain musics express their certain things.
You were mentioning the opening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony.
Yeah, oh, God. Yeah, I mean, that to me, you know, I don't know – there's something about that, especially when you consider, forget about the fact that it was, the first time I heard it was on a really awesome Deutsche Grammophon recording that's, you know, acoustically and sonically perfect. But there was something about that, and it's maybe 12 measures or something. I mean, it's not very much, but the opening is so quiet, and it's really illustrates, I think without Mahler maybe even being aware of it, of some of the ideas of silence and quiet in composition that would eventually, come out of, you know, academia and then make their way into a secular music, So, I was reading this essay by somebody, some abstract writer about silence. Silence and Music, taken from a Suzanne K. Langer book from 1958. I was reading it before I came in. And she really talks about silence and stuff there. And I believe that essay I was reading actually predates Cage's Silence, but I'm not sure. I think it does. That's a really interesting essay. So the thing of it is Mahler really had his finger on a pulse. His music is usually pretty disjointed. It's like, you know, it's loud, it's soft, it's a whole array of things all simultaneously. But it's like
sort of great degeneration of the Romantic era.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's what's strange about it is, in a lot of ways, it reminds me sort of like an orchestral Sun Ra or something with more timbres, because there's just so much more going on. It's like you can listen to like a Sun Ra piece, and you can listen to the focal point, and then it just kind of goes from there. So, and then that's how Mahler's music is. You listen to it, and you can almost pick out an instrument, a piccolo or a flute or a violin, and you can listen to its unique part all the way through. And I often wondered if that doesn't have something to do with the way he composed, like in his like villa in somewhere, Lake Geneva or somewhere around there, and he just sat every summer when he was off taking a break from his work with whatever symphony he was working for during the season, and he would just write out his symphonies on his terrace.
On his laptop.
Yeah, on his laptop. And I just wonder if after a while the instruments not only had a melodic or a harmonic, not only had a singular melodic role or multiple roles in a harmonic aspect, but I wonder if they almost took on a graphical representation as well. When you listen to his music, which is kind of interesting, which is cool. And it's something a composer like me really can't have much grasp on, because I just, you know, take an alchemical approach and go into my sonic laboratory and mix up sounds to whatever comes out when I'm done. And
but you're doing the same thing. You're still creating.
There's no graphical representation.
So what?
Graphical representation is for replicability. And, you know, something has happened to that now because now that you can store your representation in computer format, the point of having a representation for somebody else to reproduce it is lost.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I guess there is, in a way, a graphical representation, because you see the sound wave of the whole thing, which is kind of cool. But at the same time, you see the peaks and waves, but it's not the same thing, you know. You guys got the real composition hammered down, you know, with the notes.
Got the notes, the composition hammer. That's us. We got that composition hammer.
I would
get down with our five lines, and I'll tell you, we just, yeah.
Well. Smash it in.
No, I mean, seriously, that to me would be something I'd like to try, but I don't know if I have the aptitude or the aptitude for it. I'm not so sure about that. I like to think so, but Never done it yet. Maybe when I'm old or something, I don't know, I'll be like, all right, I'm going to learn how to do music like Satie. He went back to school when he was like 50 or something, 16. He decided he needed to learn more about music. Who can tell?
So there's a precedent, yeah.
Oh, yes. Let's listen to another cut, then we'll be back with some additional comments. We got a, oh, gosh, we got a short one coming up. This one is called The Hill Over Nagasaki Harbor. Is this is the title just a title, as you said
just
before?
Just a title.
Just to identify that this is the piece that's 2 minutes long or something.
The title makes up for the length, I guess.
Let's hear it. Our guest here on Galvez and Damien is Matt Borgi.
That's the end, is it?
Hi, I'm Matt Borgi, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar on the Non-Pop International Network. Non-pop, non-stop.
Here on WGDR Plainfield. Thank you, Matt, for
Ooh.
That. Yes, we were just listening to his CD, The Intercepted Transmissions, and that was one of the short pieces, which was even shorter than usual because of some sort of strange timer marking problem on the CD itself. So the piece is actually about a minute and a half, and even though it said 2 minutes and 10 when I turned it on, the hill over Nagasaki.
I know that hill.
You know that hill.
I know that hill. What? No, I don't know that hill that well. Sorry,
right.
I was just it was a metaphor.
You were being contemplative there.
I was. I fell right asleep. My brain did.
It was a meditative state.
Yeah.
The music.
Yeah.
We had a caller during that piece, and he said he I always have to paraphrase, and I sometimes mess it up, but I'll do my best. He said, I don't understand why we need that notation anymore anyway, because we have ways of doing it with computers for reproducing what we want.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a caller who kind of is encouraging you to stay away from that, I guess. I'm not sure.
Well, caller, you know what? It's looking like I'm going to stay away from it anyway. By default, I'm just kind of sticking with my computer and holding down keys. So
I still love you. That's one of the best stories I've ever heard, is that just taping down the keys.
Everyone's kind of amazed when they hear that story. It just seemed like I was able to go make some coffee and some breakfast, and the music kept recording.
And then in your later life, as you mentioned, as Eric Satie did, went back to school when he was about 50 or so and learned how to do other things.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I could do some crazy compositional stuff like Eric Satie did some crazy compositional stuff when he eliminated, what was it, key signatures and time signatures, and then John Cage and his composition.
Just before he went techno.
Yeah.
And where? So that's where you think you'll be going. You're not going techno. You'll continue to do this, and each piece will be an evolution of the previous piece, and you'll just keep going and bettering yourself and making longer pieces. Do you have to envision your own studio?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the direction right now is probably in live performance. Now it's really hard to get people where they actually want to go to a performance and listen. I mean, classical music seems to do it well, but then there's also that sort of society thing attached to it. And with this it doesn't have that. So, I guess it could. So what happens is live performance ends up sounding a lot like space rock, which is kind of like imagine those, 20, 30-minute sets in between a Grateful Dead song where they're doing the melody and the chorus, and then it just kind of goes off wherever. And they just use traditional instruments, guitars, basses, drums, things of that nature. I would really like to go, and I do to some degree, into an improvised angle, where I improvise the music, like I believe, you were talking about the caller and how he, I don't know if I can say it, but he had done some stuff with loops at one of the performances. And to me, that's really cool, because you can do stuff with the loops and the collages that those create. And what I would really like is to have like one or two or three instruments where I can build on top of those loops, and the loops sort of become organic and create themselves. Yet at the same time, without it kind of sounding like a disjointed collage, I'd rather it sound like a really profound 60, 70, 80, 90, 120-minute ambient piece that people can do whatever to, and we can record it, we can enjoy the performance, whatever, So I don't know. I'm at a loss for words. Yikes.
Yikes. What are you doing?
I'm looking for a good follow-up after we have this last piece from Matt Borgi.
You don't have any Mahler here?
I don't have any Mahler, but I was looking for something that could substitute, and I do have a piece with a long architecture. I have a piece by John McGuire, Pulse Music One, that's kind of a pulsing ambient. Well, no, we won't say that.
No.
But let's hear one more from you, Matt Borgi, before we go. This is the final cut on the album, this 12 pieces on this CD called... The Intercepted Transmissions. I just do like that title. And who is that on the cover? Is that
I have no idea. No. I don't even know what those guys look like, actually. It could be one of them. Yes. Who knows? Pretty low voices, though. But just the same, I think it was a friend of the graphic designer who did the layout and everything for the CD. I know we had the picture laying around. Usually with my releases, I opt for more of like a Windham Hill kind of angle or an ECM with like the border and then some picture centered in the middle, kind of like a, I don't know.
Just like you,
yeah,
centered in the middle.
Centered in the middle.
Yes.
So I don't know if I should say it now, but thanks for having me on here.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
thank
you.
A lot of fun. We're going to listen to the last cut from that. This is called...
Amazon.
Oh, yes. On Amazon.com. Okay,
because a lot of ambient you can't get anywhere except through the label's website, which is not always secure.
Borghi is how you spell Matt Borgi. The Cyber Zen Sound Engine and the Intercepted Transmissions. We'll have links from...
I don't know, but you can also...
Calvos.org.
Oh, that. But you can also find it now in the studio of WGDR.
Oh, yeah, it's here. Yeah, it's nice when that happens. Here is that final cut. And yet I float. Matt Borgi, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Final cut from that CD, The Intercepted Transmissions, by Matt Borgi and also by these other folks who go by Grace Note X and Smith 6079. Their names are David, was it David Clay? Is that you said his name?
One of them is Grace Note X is Dan, and Smith 6079 is Clay.
Clay, okay.
I don't
Dan,
know last names.
Dan
though,
and Clay.
Weird.
That's why I thought it was David Clay. Right. Dan and Clay. All right.
He was going to tell us about some payola, but we don't have time because
we have about 10 seconds to play the next, to make the next announcements, which are that Calvis and Damien's New Music Bazaar website is hosted by Pair Networks, www.pair.com of Pittsburgh, and sponsored by them. And our web streaming is sponsored by the Princeton String Academy. Particularly also, we had a special contribution to make possible today's show, and which I've lost. So we'll announce
Excellent.
Next week
yes.
a special contribution. Now, we have just received in our new releases a new release of a piece from a long time ago, actually, from 1975-76, John McGuire's Pulse Music One. This is an incredible piece.
Amazing, and it fits well, I think, with the program.
I think so, too. And it has been cleaned up, and just really the original recording, which was done in the electronic studio in Cologne, Germany, has now been all cleaned up. That studio has been closed, and so they managed to scurry away with some of these tapes and restore them. So here it is. See you next week with Corey Karlick as our guest.
Probably.
Thanks today to Matt Borgi for joining us. And here is Pulse Music One by John McGuire.
A production of Multimedia.